Welcome to Swallow the Gap, the podcast that delves into the critical world of dysphagia practice in education. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Stockdale, and I'm thrilled to have you join us for conversations aiming to bridge gaps in understanding, knowledge, and implementation surrounding dysphagia intervention. We will be a force for change by inspiring critical thinking, facilitating discussion, and promoting professional development. Swallow the Gap is here to discuss, inform, inspire, and connect you with a vibrant community who is dedicated to making positive change. Together, we'll unpack challenges and be open about our own struggles and work to bridge gaps in our field that impact the lives of those living with swallowing difficulties. Our opinions should not be taken to represent our employers or the groups with whom we associate. Nothing we say is legal advice, and nothing should be taken without scrutiny. While we strive for accuracy, we do not imply perfection. We value diversity in backgrounds and opinions, so our guests will not always reflect what we believe. In fact, we may change our minds on topics as we learn, because this is how progress is made. Through discussion, critical thinking, and open minds, we serve as catalysts for advancement in medically focused speech-language pathology. Today, our guest is soon-to-be Dr. Matthew Ward. He defends his dissertation on Thursday to earn his PhD. He teaches medical speech-language pathology courses at Middle Tennessee State University, and he also teaches basic and advanced fees courses and is the director of clinical education at SA Swallowing Services, who has graciously sponsored this episode. Please check them out at sassplc.com. They offer basic and advanced fees training and even a fees competency training program. Please check them out. A recent study was published in which 55% of individuals coming from acute care facilities who were NPO had no instrumentation done. 61% of individuals with feeding tubes didn't even have dysphagia. And 67% of those on a modified diet didn't have dysphagia. And so you probably heard about that, Bice et al. 2023. Today I have one of the authors of that, the soon-to-be in what, maybe a week, Dr. Matthew Ward. Matt, it's a pleasure to have you on here. This was like a whirlwind getting on here very last minute, and you seem like such a humble individual. I really appreciate you being here and also putting up with all the crap that I've been putting you through last minute to get me prepared to interview. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm happy to be here. This is kind of what happened. You have common friends in this small world of being an SLP, and it's been a whirlwind, but you re-research by somebody and you're like, oh, you kind of have this picture of them in your head as somebody that you couldn't approach at a conference or something. Right. When in actuality, asking a researcher to talk about their research is like asking someone to show you a picture of their child or of their dog. They always want to do it. They want to show you more pictures than you want to see. So yeah, you said, do you want to talk about this? And I was like, sure. And so I'm happy to be here. I know I've listened to several of your podcasts and with Dr. Ashford, who's my mentor. I had listened to that one as well. So I was happy to do it. Happy to be here.
Yeah, there are a lot of connections here. So you work with Dr. John Ashford with SA Swallowing Services, right? You have a lot of good stuff. Go out and take their courses. I mean, I am working selling CE courses. I have no problem referring to other good ones. This is a synergistic relationship that we're in this together. We've got to push our field forward together. And so that's what this is about. And again, Matt, like you and I were talking earlier, there's no room for ego either. I don't think there's room for ego.
No.
There isn't, because the more you learn, the more you're like, man, I was dumb before this. At least that's how I feel. I still feel that way. Like I was saying, like, I need you to explain this article to me like I'd be intelligence of a hamster. And you're not going to be it's not too far-fetched, but like still, like everyone will get it. I'll understand it. But yeah, again, thank you so much for coming on. You'll have a PhD soon. I'm sure that was extremely hard work, but you'll be done soon, right?
Hopefully. Yeah, I defend Thursday. And as long as I don't mess that up, I should be good to go.
Excellent. Excellent. That is such a big deal. And what's really important about this is you talked about being very practically focused in your research. Can you tell me a little bit about that? You said you're an applied scientist.
I think we've all, like from elementary school, middle school, high school, you're learning about all sorts of things that you may not be all that interested in. And your teachers are telling you, whether it's calculus or whether it's history, whatever subject you didn't love, they're telling you about all these theories and these great authors in the field and these great scientists, and they came up with this theory. And theories very rarely are practical to people who don't work in that field. So you're just sitting there learning it and you're like, okay. So for me, the journey to be a researcher and the journey to be a PhD started with very practical questions. I started off in SNFs. That was the first 5 years of my career were in SNFs. And in SNFs, you're kind of on dysphagia island. You're out there by yourself a lot of times. And I feel bad for my patients because I think they got better in spite of me. But I wanted to learn more. I always wanted to know more. You know, you have a few patients in a row with a certain diagnosis and you're like, am I doing enough for those patients? Yeah. And so my questions come not necessarily from understanding the theory of sort of basic science in our field. It comes from, well, I had trouble treating patients with this disorder or this disease. I didn't feel like I was that effective. So how could I be better? I would read and I would ask questions, and that's how my research has evolved as well. And so you find like individuals on this journey, and Ed Bice and Dr. Chris Galick are both colleagues and friends of mine. And they were doing this research project and said, hey, do you want to provide some of the data and be one of the authors on this study with us? And it's a really simple, well-designed study that has practical implications. Sign me up. How quickly do you need me to be part of this? Yeah. That's the question I was asking back.
I would love to know a little bit more about this study. And so I'm going to put a mark in that. The name of the study is Dysphagia and Diets in Skilled Nursing Facilities, When Patients' Health Status Changes, The Role of Imaging. So I want to get into a little bit more of that, but I really want to follow up on something that you said first. You were talking about how we learn and how we've learned things in school about calculus, mitosis, like whatever these things are that maybe don't have a lot of practical application unless we're doing, PhD, studying something very, very specific. And that is important. I don't want to undermine that at all. But I feel like also, unless we have a big picture, overall context, an overall idea of what it is we're working with, that it's harder to really make hypotheses that make any sense. It's like the comparison I've used before. Everybody's heard this. It's cliche, but you're feeling the trunk of an elephant. I'm feeling the foot, the tail, and whatever. We don't know. We have our perspective and we can add all these parts together and maybe guess what it is. But unless we have the big picture of what it is and why it matters, what it does, then it doesn't really translate to what we're doing so well. So I really, truly, genuinely appreciate what you're doing as far as it being practical, because as healthcare providers in our field, we have a lot of responsibility, but also we're better learning how to prepare for this responsibility. And I don't think we're there yet, but I am really happy to see the direction that so many of us are moving in. So thank you for doing that, Matt. Would you mind talking to me a little bit about what was the catalyst for this research and kind of maybe summarizing it before we go into a little bit more detail?
Yeah, I don't mind that at all. Ed Bice, I've known, how long have I known Ed now? Ed's kind of a kindred soul. Our personalities are very different, but we seem to ask a lot of the same questions and come to a lot of the same conclusions. And one of the conclusions that Ed and I really rapidly realized we were coming to, maybe individually and then together, is that changing people's diets is not medicine. It's not really the way healthcare is designed. It's certainly not rehabilitation medicine. It asks very little of our patients. It is like handing a patient a walker. If all PTs did would hand a patient a walker when they were having trouble walking, PTs wouldn't have a lot of respect from doctors. They wouldn't have a job for very long. You're not, strengthening the muscles and rehabbing that patient and testing their balance and coordination and all of those things that are important to be walking. And so knowing that diet texture intervention and liquid viscosity intervention is the number one thing. So much so that one of my dissertation committee readers, who is not a speech therapist, she said, well, you haven't talked much about in your dissertation what other SLPs or what SLPs do other than modifying diets. And I said, because as a field, we don't do much other than alter diets. Now, I know there's a lot of us out there who are learning about rehab medicine, learning about principles of exercise physiology. I know a lot of people are fighting the good fight, but I still have to say, as someone who trains worldwide and trains nationwide, as a field, no more than 50, like we're not to a critical mass yet. We're more than 50% of us are using this sort of research-based, very, very valuable to our patients, sort of tools to help them. What we're doing is we're saying, hey, you have trouble swallowing. here's some thickened liquids and here's an altered diet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we'll do some exercises, maybe we won't, but that's what we do. So the clinical passion for both Ed and I, to get back to your question, is understanding the efficacy of modified diets and the clinical utility, what role they serve, what roles they don't serve, but also thinking about very specifically, we treat diets in this field, modifying them, as unlike anything else that I have seen in medicine. Stopping people from aspirating has been the number one concern for our field since 1971 or 72. I can't remember when George Larson first wrote his article, but 71 or 72. Changing people's diets and stopping them from aspirating, regardless of what those textures do to people. Mm-hmm. And what's come out over the last 25, 30 years of research is, just like everything in medicine, there are significant, or can be significant, side effects associated with these treatments. Mm-hmm. Nothing else in medicine is treated as if it has no side effects.
Right.
Terminally ill cancer patients refuse treatment all the time because the side effects just are not worth it for their quality of life. And so we have had, as a field, this myopic focus on stopping people from aspirating. And the data is now telling us that that's not stopping them from getting pneumonia. And not only is it not stopping them from getting pneumonia, and not only is there a lack of evidence, there is a mountain of evidence saying that there are other serious side effects. And those other serious side effects, if they're happening with frequency, and they can, we need to be thinking about, do these patients actually have dysphagia? And do we need these diets? And if we need them, for how long do we need them? What is our risk analysis of them? Sure, there are lots of things in medicine that are risky. Doctors prescribe opiates to patients all the time still. There's an opiate pandemic in this world. There's an epidemic in the United States. It ruins lives. Families are ruined. Like, there is a whole thing, but doctors didn't stop prescribing them. They just became more careful about how they used them. So mm-hmm. I don't want anyone to hear me talk and think there is never a reason that someone needs a modified diet texture. I don't want anyone to hear that. But I do want people to hear, we need to be careful with these things because they can be dangerous. Right. And so that's, anything relating to that is sort of the catalyst. And then specifically for this project, there are some unwritten rules in any field. And so this is what becoming an expert in your field means, is you sort of become conversant in those rules. And I don't know if you've seen this, but I've seen this throughout my career. Mm-hmm. Personally, I saw it. And then going in as a mobile fees endoscopist now, I see it in other clinicians. What happens when a patient gets discharged from a hospital to the next level of care? It's typically, even in facilities who have great administrators and contracts with mobile fees and mobile modified companies, there is a barrier of time sometimes, or a cost barrier associated. So getting another fees or another modified after they've left the hospital is hard. It's just harder. And so there are days or sometimes weeks that go by before another swallow study is done.
Yeah.
So you as an SLP are left in a lurch. You are left in this spot where someone maybe did a swallow study in acute care and you haven't done one yet. How am I going to say, as someone who hasn't done a study, that you no longer have dysphagia when the last person looked and said you did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really difficult position to be put
guilty in. Until proven innocent, sort of. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I have no problem with people being stuck in that. And I understand that. But what we wanted to know is how many people are coming, and mm-hmm. then what is happening when they're getting that follow-up modified or fees. Now, all of our data, because Chris is involved with one of her companies that she works with, is a mobile fees company. Mm-hmm. Our company in Tennessee is a mobile fees company. So they're all fees. And if you wonder mm-hmm. why we're a mobile fees company, not a mobile modified company, in Tennessee, the statutes make it impossible right now to have a mobile modified company. So they don't exist in Tennessee. It's not that we don't like them. I love them. I trained on them first. But if you're wondering why all of our data is from fees companies, it's because that's what we got. That's what we had access to.
Yeah. So it's basically, at this point, it was the practical thing to do, which you're still getting a lot of great information from doing a fees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. There are a couple of things that you said. And again, I say this every episode, like there are so many things that I could talk about, as we could talk forever. And I just mentioned a few things, and I think I could, you know, follow up with that. The idea of a critical mass, that there's some people like trying to do the right things, but and really pushing hard, but we're not at a critical mass. And so that's like, could go into a conversation about what is a critical mass and how do we like strategically plan and forecast and act in such a way to help the field get better? Because They're not only people who are doing the right thing or doing things better than they were 5 years ago or 1 year ago, but there are people who are pushing for change more broadly too, not just in their own practice, but are trying to help others to learn better too. So that's something I really appreciate. You also mentioned the idea that it's, to me, this is what I thought of. It's easy to swing from one side to the other. So you wanted, as I understood it, to be sure that people didn't think that you're saying there's never a reason for a modified diet, right?
Yeah, that's great.
I've just seen this pattern in my life in anything, any sort of argument, that it's easy to like something gets discredit or largely discredit. And so we go to the other side rather than actually thinking it through enough and thinking it through about the why would this work and in what context would it work, that we just swing. It's like, okay, all modified diets are bad or all these are bad. And you go back and forth like ping pong, and it's really foolish, in my opinion, versus thinking about, well, what makes it not work in that circumstance and what could make it work or what would be a circumstance that it would work in. And so, like I said, we could talk about a lot of these things that I would love to.
No, I do think that in large part speaks to what I believe the role of a researcher is. And the role of a researcher, if you're a researcher, you understand that you get a lot, you put a lot of hats on. But one of the things I think our job is to adequately communicate scientific information to those who need it on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have the time to do that, all of us have different issues, whether it's the health situations in family members. My mom's currently going through chemo and cancer right now. My personal life and my professional life have changed because of that.
Sure.
Regardless of what your issues are, you are not required to be an SLP and go home and read a journal article every day. You're not required to have a full understanding of everything about our profession. What I do believe as researchers, we ought to be able to communicate is, one, the importance of what we're studying, mm-hmm. and two, the framework. Where does this fit in? And finding the nuance. You're right. It is really easy to polarize. It's all bad or it's all good. Because when you have limited time and limited resources, and limited resources can be mentally, like during a day, I'm fatigued.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Limited resources can just be, I don't have the energy to do that today.
Yeah,
it is beneficial and helpful for us to explain that. So that's why I like the research article we're going to talk about. I also think of the Wizard of Oz pulling back the curtain a little bit and demystifying mm-hmm. everything a little bit to say, researchers are really just people who are asking questions and understanding the context of those questions. Like you talked about the catalyst or how we got started is important. It's in fact, to me, couching this article in terms of why we did it, how we did it is important, but also knowing where mm-hmm. this article fits in the grand scheme of things for us as a profession is also very, very, very important to me. And so that's why I'm always happy to come on and talk about the research.
Yeah. Well, you've touched on the catalyst for it some, but I would love to hear just a little bit more kind of what pushed you in this direction and what did you find in your research?
So mm-hmm. my first 5 years, I was a SNF clinician and all I'm really doing is evaluating and treating every day. My current job allows me to clinically teach for like professional education, continuing education. And then I've done some like guest lectures here and there. And then I also, for my PhD, have TA'd. So when you teach, you start asking different questions. And so for me, when I was a practicing clinician, what I was really concerned about is what are my recommendations doing to my patients? Are they benefiting enough from them? As someone who teaches and now as someone who researches, one of the burning questions I have is, as a field, are we doing more harm than good? I don't think this is too harsh. It sounds too harsh, but I don't think it is. I think if we only care about diets for the rest of our careers, and that's all we do is change people's diets, then I do believe we're doing more harm than good.
That's something that's come up. And I think two podcasts ago, I asked that. I think it was with Rinky and I think it was with Jeanette. That very thing. And I do want to couch that a little bit because we're 9 diagnostic categories. So to say our profession, it's specifically talking about dysphagia management. And I think you couched it even further, specifically within the realm of diet recommendation too, right? So just to throw that out there so people aren't thinking like, this podcast is slamming SLPs or Matt slamming SLPs, because I don't think you are. I think we have to look in the mirror. We have to look at how things are in order to make things better. There's a principle in leadership, and I thought I knew who said it, and then I mentioned it on the podcast. I think I mentioned their name, and I couldn't find it, so I'm not even going to pretend I know who said it. But if you don't know yourself, how can you lead yourself? So how can you make yourself better unless you dig into the nitty-gritty? And something we got to look at.
Well, yeah. And I'm glad you said that. You know, I talk a lot. I talk a lot for a living. And so sometimes I don't always say everything I want to say because I talk so much. One of the things I do want to say, and I say this when I'm teaching professionally with active everyday clinicians, if you hear me say something I'm passionate about, if you hear me say something that is hard for you to hear, I understand that. I've been there. I don't know if we can't honestly talk about the state of our profession. I don't know how we can be any better. That doesn't mean we're bad. My doctor is a friend of mine. He's a good friend. And I get frustrated sometimes and I talk to him about things. And he says, you know, this is every profession, Matt. Doctors and nurses are the same way. Getting people to practice with evidence-based medicine takes more time, more energy, and usually sometimes more money from an institutional point of view, which makes all of those things are harder. Every one of those makes it a little bit harder to do what the latest research came out and said, now this is what we need to do. And do I believe you need to change every time an article comes out? No. And one of the things I want to very specifically say is, and I say this to every group that I talk to personally, so I'm glad you brought this up. I do not believe that there is greater than 1%, if there's even that many, SLPs who are not trying to do the best for their patients. That is key for me because
that's huge.
Most people got into healthcare, whether they are still that way or not, most people got into healthcare, whether you're a doctor, a nurse, a PT, to help people. Mm-hmm. And I understand that is probably the major driving factor continuing you along this journey.
Yeah. I agree. And I think sometimes we forget and then we hear stories about tremendous impact. But I think one of the things maybe, this is so multifaceted. I think one of the things maybe that allow us to forget that we got into this profession to help people is because maybe one, we see people for a short period of time, or two, if one of the primary modalities of our treatment is using modified diets and we aren't seeing improvement from that, that it might make us think that we're not really helping people. And so that then becomes this existential crisis, and you might forget why you got into healthcare versus you did something and it worked, or it seemed to work. You did something again and it seemed to work. And you're seeing all these people get better, like maybe aphasia treatment or something else, or dysphagia. There are a lot of people who are helping in dysphagia. Like, we care, but when you get the reinforcement of seeing how valuable you can be, that to me, it keeps the fire going. It's like the spark's not going to burn out because it's deprived of oxygen, but it's getting fanned, it's getting the fuel, and it allows us to be passionate about what we do. So I think within this, even though there is criticism within it, it's not personal criticism. It's not criticism of you. It's not criticism of me. In fact, it says we as a profession are caring. We're loving. We're perhaps some of the most caring, loving people out there.
Yeah.
But agreed. There are things that are keeping us from reaching our potential. And I'm getting really worked up. I didn't even talk about this. I'm getting really worked up though. But the thing that's cool is we also have people who are pushing so hard to make this better. And I'm more hopeful now than I've ever been as far as making things better. I have been, and that may not be a reflection of reality, but I've been happy with that. I feel like we're pushing in a good direction.
Yeah, I do believe sometimes you have to come out of an ivory tower and remember what it's like to work every day in a clinical setting. And I do work every day in a clinical setting, but when you start doing research, it's a highly solitary process. And so you can forget some of the things that happen every day. Yes, it is hard for us as a field to move forward if we can't say what is actually going on in our field. And the simple fact of the matter is, I like that you brought it up. It does create an existential crisis. When I talk about this stuff, I can see it in people's faces. We have been for a long time de facto pneumonia prevention specialists in hospitals and in healthcare in general. And the data is saying we don't prevent it very well, or our current interventions don't. And that is scary. But I think if you ask me, anything that can be scary can also be exciting, and exciting for good reasons. Mm-hmm. For me, it seems like there is a dysphagia renaissance. The circles that I run in with the people that are trying to do clinical research and clinicians that I work with every day who are trying to do better for their patients, it does seem to me, I share your optimism, it seems to me that we are in a space where we've been doing something for about 1.5 generations of clinicians, and it's time for some of those things to change. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like there's a dysphagia renaissance happening. Like, we are pulling up all the ugly stuff and looking at it and examining it. And that's just part of growing. It doesn't mean anyone's motivations were wrong. It means definitions are changing. Jerry Logeman told us back in 96, I think, that swallowing was supposed to begin. It was supposed to be triggered when the head of the bolus reached the ramus of the mandible.
Right.
It turns out Bonnie Martin Harris has done some work with normals. Inessa Humbert, others have done work with normals. And all of a sudden, it turns out college students swallow when the bolus is in the piriform sometimes. Healthy college students. So it's not that anyone was wrong. It's not that Jerry Logeman wasn't great for our profession. She was largely the matriarch of our profession because she's the one who said, we have to look at this. Mm-hmm. We have to actually not just feel it or listen to it. We have to look at it in some way. There's nothing wrong with what she did. If I was existing 30 years ago, I would probably be, instead of talking about modified textures, I'd be talking about the need for instrumentation. Largely the people that came before me have done that. And largely those arguments are settled. So what am I talking about now? I'm standing on their shoulders talking about now that we're looking, what are we seeing and what are our interventions doing? And are they effective?
Well, and that's so much of the science of healthcare or public health or anything. Yeah. Right. I mean, you saw with the COVID pandemic, people were so critical initially because like, oh, this is what we think. And it wasn't necessarily they were just totally wrong about this or totally wrong about that. You know, some things maybe, but it's a progress. Like this is the best we know right now. So with dysphagia management, maybe that was like with what Jerry Logeman said about the pharyngeal swallow triggering at the ramus of the mandible. That was what it appeared to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into that. And I don't want to like unfold that. But at the same time, like the science and the science of healthcare is in getting better and have a growth mindset for becoming better. And the whole issue of vulnerability is absolutely essential within that, because if we're not willing to be vulnerable, it means we're not willing to admit that we're wrong. And if we're not willing to admit that we're wrong, dramatic pause for intention, we don't belong in healthcare. We don't belong in healthcare and we don't belong in science. Because our patients are more important than we are, and we're human, and we're going to be wrong at times, and it's okay. But if our drive is to be better and to have a growth mindset, to be willing to do that, and to see this as an opportunity for growth, kind of as you mentioned, that's where there's so much hope to me. So yeah, thanks. A great reminder, Matt.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned growth mindset, because there's not another area in medicine where I can think of where it's not designed on, or it's not intended to be growing. I mean, doctors have to take boards every 5 years. If I have cancer on my brain right now, because my mom's going through it. If my mom went to an oncologist who said, oh, I'm doing the same thing we did in 1971, I would look at her twice and say, we probably need a different oncologist, or at least we need a second opinion, because I know things have changed since 1971. I know there have been changes in massive changes in treatment. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I do agree that it is hard to change, but I will say to you, it has been a highly autobiographical experience for me. The things I was doing as a CF for my patients, largely they got better in spite of me, because I think I was doing things like, here, do five Masakos. Like, what do five Masakos do for you? If we know things about principles of exercise physiology now, and about the types of muscle and what it takes for motor learning to occur and muscle and brain plasticity to take over, we need hundreds of repetitions, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of repetitions. And so I'm looking back at myself going, that wasn't very good. And so I can either feel guilty for that and just say, I'm just going to crawl in a hole and do what I know to do, or do what I think is best. Or I can say, look, I can constantly be assessing what the literature says about my patients and what I see with my patients when I see them every day. Is the literature matching what I'm seeing? Or are there other questions? Or is there more nuance to add to this? And so I think this article sits largely in that spot. You know, what nuance do we need to add to this? I think is very helpful. And like most things that are simple, you can talk about it for 5 minutes or you can talk about it for 5 hours.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've done a whole lot of building up anticipation for this. I would love to hear what are some of the most surprising things that you think came out of this article.
So for me,
maybe surprise isn't the word, but maybe the potentially alarming things.
No, that is the fun thing about research for me, is you kind of get all this data, you determine how you're going to collect it, and what I know no one else gets. And not that I get excited about statistics, but it is very exciting to see where data leads you, because you might be looking at something in a different way or in a different light. You might be confirming something, or you might just be adding more illumination to a problem that you didn't even know existed. So for me, I think we knew there was that assumption that patients can't be the same when they are at a post-acute care facility. Now, this paper is about SNFs specifically, but I will talk to anyone who works in post-acute care. The fact that your patient is stable enough to transfer, and I know they're getting sicker every day and being transferred when they're sicker every day from hospitals, but the fact that they're stable enough to transfer means there has been a change in them. And we know dysphagia is secondary always to a primary medical problem.
Yeah.
And so knowing that their health status changed, there's just, I don't think any of us thought of it this way. Because I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with Ed and Chris over the years, and Ed specifically, I don't think that any of us thought about that there was a disconnect, but there is something sort of mentally, almost subconsciously, where you're going, well, if they've changed enough to transfer, why are we continuing recommendations made in acute care? Mm-hmm. Should yeah. we be?
Well, there should be a new plan of care, because the old one should end at discharge.
Right.
So are we reassessing?
Right. And so what we know is, I think what we know as a field is instrumentation is about the only way to really figure out and fully inform your patient. If we're going to talk about fully informing patients, I mean, we could talk another 6 hours about informed consent for all of the things. But
sure,
you know, if we're really going to fully inform a patient, I'm going to need to know the most information. Now, there are certainly barriers to getting people modifieds and barriers to getting them fees. But I do not believe those barriers exist at such high numbers. And we're seeing in every survey of clinical practice patterns of SLPs that I read, in just in working with SLPs around the country and in doing this research, I'm seeing alarmingly high numbers of people being treated for dysphagia without confirmation that they have it based on behavioral symptoms. And that is problematic. I use this example a lot. So if anyone who's listening to this has heard me talk before, they're probably going to roll their eyes because they've heard me say this. But if I went to my general practitioner with a cough, there's a lot of things he could do based on what that cough is. If I have pneumonia, maybe it's an antibiotic or an antiviral. If I have a cough that's a chronic cough, that's going to be a different treatment. If I have a cough secondary to GERD, maybe we have to treat the underlying GERD. If I have COPD and it's an exacerbation of that, there's so much that matters. And if I went to a doctor that just said, oh, everyone who has a cough gets this, that would be problematic for that doctor. And that would be problematic for us as a profession. And largely, we don't have an intervention for managing dysphagia. We have an intervention for rehabbing it. Principles of exercise physiology, I do believe those are being published. Those are being talked about. That information is making it out to your everyday SLPs. Continues to need to be pushed out there, but that's making it out there. We don't have a great way to manage people's dysphagia. How do we get enough calories and nutrients into these patients who have dysphagia? So that's largely the number of patients who are receiving a diagnosis of oropharyngeal dysphagia without confirmation they have it is shocking in general in our profession every time I see an actual number from a study, and also in this study. Yeah. I know it exists, but the number seems too high.
So back to a few of those numbers, I have 67, at least based upon your sample, that 60% of patients with a modified diet had no dysphagia, 61% of SNF residents with feeding tubes had no dysphagia. Feeding tubes. My mom and I were talking about this last night. She was talking about, if I have to have a feeding tube and I have to be on a ventilator, just don't do it, because her dad had a severe brainstem stroke and was debilitated. And I went through and looked at these data and quoted some of them to her. I was like, well, but mom, you know, a lot of people have feeding tubes, actually don't need them. And so there are more layers to that. But anyway, another stat from that, 55% of individuals who are NPO had no instrumentation.
Yeah. And I will say, I don't want any of my acute care friends to think I'm pointing the finger at them. I have worked in acute care. I train people in acute care to this day. I get that people are getting discharged before you can see them.
Yeah,
my point to us as a profession is, and people say this all the time, is the patient healthy enough? Is that representative? Would that swallow study be representative of what they're going to be like in a couple of days? My counterpoint to that is, I don't know how to treat you if I don't take a look. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to fully inform you that you would benefit for treatment versus non-treatment if I don't tell you I know you have it.
Well, Matt, what if other medical health cares? What if other medical professions practice that way in the acute phases, right? So in the acute phases, things are changing. They're active. well, let's not do a chest x-ray today because we don't know if it's going to be that way tomorrow, or let's not do a CT of the brain because, you know, it might not be something that we can do anything with anyway. So let's just wait and see. And that underscores there are a lot of needs in acute care and things are changing, but that might also mean that you need more scans within that period of time. Like it that doesn't compute for me. It doesn't work.
It doesn't for me either. And I get the barriers. And on this, I would say it's one of those things that, to quote one of my relatives, say, let's put a pin in that. That would be the thing that we need to keep pushing for, reducing the barriers to multiple instrumental studies during a single hospitalization. Because you're right, chest x-ray is a great example. It's one I use all the time. If doctors are concerned about pneumonia or any sort of pulmonary complication, they will rapidly do another CT. They will rapidly do serial chest x-rays over multiple days to make sure that infiltrates aren't growing or that the therapy that they're using is working for that patient.
Sure.
You know, I get people, I do think there are a lot of arguments in our field that are old. And one of the arguments is fees better than a modified? I don't care. If you need both, do both. If you need both multiple times, do both multiple times. That is an argument I do not want to have. That's an old argument. Let's find the instrumental studies that answer the clinical questions we have, use those and use them as many times as we need to.
Yeah. Well, Matt, and what you said too, there's the potential that we'll do, could do multiplied, modified variants. Did I say multiplified? I told you I'm very sleep deprived. I am going to sound like the hugest idiot, which is probably good because this is kind of a sensitive topic. And so at least people will be like, they will feel bad about themselves and be like, I'm not going to pay attention to the word that dummy says. But what I was saying, there is potential for there to be multiple modified barium swallow studies. Let's say that somebody is not very common, but is in an acute care facility for 10 days. Let's say they're there for 10 days. So let's say maybe on day two or three, they get a modified. Who knows? So first, they might not even have dysphagia. So if they don't have dysphagia, you can discharge them. Then you don't have to worry about them getting multiple studies. You don't have to worry about if anything's changed, because if it changes, it's just going to be better than no dysphagia, which is great. Or, you know, you get severe dysphagia, but you identify the pathophysiology that are impaired. And say maybe you know that it's, you know, medullary stroke. And so you see these particular pathophysiology, and you might have a better idea of prognosis and like, oh yeah, it makes sense that that's tied to the medullary stroke and that sort of thing. So at least as things are improving, you might say if, I don't know, the middle pharyngeal constrictor is markedly reduced in its range of motion or whatever, that you can still work on the pharyngeal stripping wave versus like maybe there's, and I don't know how you quantify severe versus mild in these things. I'm not implying that we can measure more than we can, but maybe, oh, I don't know, AP transfer is slightly impaired, but you could still see things proportionally and also the things that maybe have the biggest impact on the patient and work on those. It gives you a plan. And if you have to do another study because you think they've changed, great. If your patient's better, that is fantastic. But still, if we don't see and we don't analyze, I really think that in most cases, we don't know.
Yeah. And I do think it part of this comes from this shift that we're looking at. I think if we're talking about a sort of a sea change or a shift in sort of the culture of how SLPs treat dysphagia, it is not independent of itself. I do believe changing and all of that came during a time when I will say healthcare was more paternalistic. Your doctor sort of looked at your scans and then came and told you what was going to happen. That was what was happening.
They were going to save you.
Yes. And you know, you're going to take this drug and you're going to do this thing. And healthcare has evolved to more of a patient-centered model. And I don't know how to adequately exist or operate in a patient-centered model if I can't help you understand what's going on. And for me to help you understand what's going on, I have to know what's going on. I have to be able to tell you pathophysiology, whether or not you actually have dysphagia to begin with, pathophysiology of that, what the prognosis might be, and therefore, would you benefit from treatment versus non-treatment of that? And what would the treatments look like? What would the side effects or possible outcomes of those treatments be, positive and negative? And so I do think that's also where we're feeling a push to be more patient-centered. And I do believe that is the best way to go, helping your patients understand. But I do not believe we can help them understand if we don't fully understand. That's another big piece.
Right. These episodes take hours and hours to put together, and I'm very thankful that SA Swallowing Services has sponsored this episode. They work with Dr. John Ashford and today's guest, soon to be Dr. Matthew Ward. They provide a variety of fees training, so please see SASSPLLC.com. Check out their professional education and much more. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think sometimes in shifting from a paternalistic mentality to facilitating autonomy, if we're not careful, there can be this swing that just, oh, you're the patient. It's patient-centered. You do whatever you want. But there's still this expertise we bring to the table. We have to provide some sort of a value, and the value in helping them to understand this is what we see, a differential diagnosis. These are the potential implications of that. These are possible treatments, and these are the potential positive or negative implications of the treatment. And so you're helping them not only to provide them information that they understand the potential prognosis and the outcome and things that could happen to them and harm them from treatment, but maybe like a decision-making framework too. So there's still equally as much, if not more, that we can bring to the table while also giving up some of our, what's it called, directiveness, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and I do think there's a large concern. This is going to connect back to a point we were talking about earlier. There's a large existential crisis about maybe we're not the pneumonia prevention specialists anymore. Well, if you ask me, what can be exciting about that is we have largely focused on one system, the pulmonary system, and we can help prevent things in that pulmonary system. Well, it turns out the data says that diets, at least, don't do that. They don't really prevent it very well at all. In fact, sometimes modified diets can end up being the cause of pulmonary complications. But for me, it's exciting because there's not a system in your body that is not touched by the ability to deliver nutrients and water to those cells. Every system is involved. We are involved so much more in the holistic version of patient homeostasis than we really fully understand. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what diets have sort of backed us into. Diets, because they are 24/7, and diets, because they are such a large part of people's lives, have allowed us to see that these things that we're making recommendations based on whether or not you might get pneumonia from aspirating that material, these recommendations are having systemic effects. Like our recommendations for modified diets might have effects on your kidneys, or they might have effects on delirium. So we're talking neurological system, we're talking your kidneys, and we're talking about central processes. So I do think for me, it's exciting because we don't have to just focus on the lungs. Sure, I do think there's a role there. But our role in being experts is, and this is where I do believe people all the time will say our field doesn't get as much respect as it should. They always send the PT notes to SNFs, but they don't send this SOP notes to SNFs. And people are like, well, we should know more. You know, PTs know more about muscles. Doctors don't. The doctors I've interacted with, in large part, don't care what we know. And that's a crass way of putting it, but it really and truly is. They don't care that we understand the neurology of swallowing. They don't care that we understand the muscles. They don't want to understand that. What they want from us is a recommendation for their swallowing that will improve nutrition and hydration. And they also need to us to be able to tell them how our recommendations will impact the rest of their patient. If our recommendations are going to impact another system or multiple other systems, and we're able to talk fluently about that with doctors, you get their respect real fast. Like, this is why I wouldn't prescribe thickened liquids for this patient. Yeah, we could thicken their liquids. That might help them not aspirate. But those thickened liquids in this patient, we're talking about delayed gastric emptying in someone who's got a lot of reflux already that's known and it's not well controlled. I don't want to delay their gastric emptying. I don't want them refluxing more. The last thing I want someone aspirating is gastric or esophageal contents. Now you're talking acute respiratory distress, and you're talking about increased rates of mortality that spike really, really highly. And so for me, the exciting part of this is we don't have to focus only on the lungs anymore. So we're not taking the thing that you have been. And a lot of people, that existential crisis is, I've been the person who can stop pneumonia. We are the people who not only could maybe stop some pneumonias, I do believe we can help people in that way.
And prevent them as well.
But I also do believe we can help many other systems, not just the pulmonary system.
Well, I think that's cool about this too, because some of the things in letting go, it's we're maybe afraid we're letting go of value, the value and the purpose that we serve. But within this, there is still so much purpose. It's not like there is absolutely no correlation between dysphagia and pneumonia. It may not look like what we think it looked like, and it may be not maybe, but there are other things that are much, much more significant correlating factors. And so, but it's the idea that, like, well, this method of what we're doing isn't the best method to prevent it. So, but maybe there are other things, like working on laryngeal valve timing or laryngeal valve closure, or just doing things that have more evidence as far as not only maybe preventing aspiration, but in helping to swallow in other ways, or really facilitating oral hygiene in an interprofessional sense, or providing education for timing with particular things. I'm having a really hard time kind of like bringing that thought back around and executing it. But whether or not it is that we're giving up this idea of we're important and this is why, it doesn't take away the value from what we do, because we may help to prevent pneumonia in another way, but we also may help to facilitate nutrition, hydration, quality of life, reduce length of stay and reduce cost and so many other things. And so I think it's really important to focus on that.
Well, there's a lot to that. Originally, that's what my dissertation topic was going to be, was I had some data collection issues, so we didn't end up focusing on this, but I can talk at length about this is, you know, early mobility programs with PT, they're really popular now because early mobility, getting people up in the ICU, getting people up who are on vents, because we're not made to sit, mm-hmm. or not made to lay in bed all day. And so PTs were banging the drum on, we need to get these people up. Well, they weren't, mm-hmm. You can't tell me that a PT was banging the drum because they knew that people would have lower rates of pneumonia, that people's blood pressure would decrease. There's all these non-PT things that started happening to people when they mm-hmm. started getting them up and started doing these early mobility programs. Wound healing got better. You started seeing these people have reduced rates of pneumonia, reduced rates of delirium, quality of life starts getting better. All these things that are not necessarily directly related to a PT. So if you ask me, what I was looking at in my dissertation research is anecdotally, we had some evidence at one of the hospitals we work with a lot. They were highly cautious about letting us do swallow studies with their patients early on mm-hmm. because they didn't want them to aspirate during the study, let alone eating and drinking. And so they keep data on that. And those patients who were getting swallow studies weren't getting pneumonia at any higher rates that weren't. So then they became, mm-hmm. okay, we'll let you do all the studies, but we don't want to implement a diet. Maybe this patient is too medically fragile, too medically complex. We don't mm-hmm. want to start a diet. Well, it turns out the people we were starting a diet on weren't having worse outcomes than the patients who we weren't starting diets on. Then they started looking at things like, not only are they not having worse outcomes, the people who were starting diets on sooner, who are appropriate. So this is starting diets mm-hmm. on a patient who's in an LTAC. So very, very sick patients on the vent. Starting diets sooner on them not only meant that they had fewer negative complications, it also meant her director of the SLP working there, her director of rehab came to her and said, these patients that we start on diets, they participate more in PT and OT than patients mm-hmm. we don't start on diets. You know, these people, her wound care doctor came to her and said, your patients who start oral diets sooner than others, their wounds heal faster. And so her discharge planner said, we're discharging your patients on diets faster. Now that could be a correlation. They're getting better faster. But what we were seeing is not only were there not more negative outcomes starting a diet earlier, there were more positive outcomes, and some of them weren't even related to speech. And so for me, I was looking at that going, we need to study this in a real way mm-hmm. to determine if this is like early mobility. If we get people who are appropriate eating and drinking as quickly as possible, can we quantify the change? Is there, and I'm not saying that we have proven this yet, but I have saying we have kept preliminary data, and we were seeing in these patients better wound healing faster. We were seeing decreased lengths of stay. We were seeing more participation in other therapies. And you can only imagine quality of life skyrockets in these patients when they start eating and drinking faster. I mean, we go into this place and people, it's an LTAC and people haven't been eating and drinking for months. And we say, yeah, it's time to start eating and drinking something. It could be anything. And these patients and their families are crying. They're so happy. Like, can dad have a Dr. Pepper or whatever? Like,
Go for it, man.
So quality of life improves. So I do think, and when we are far, I do not want to represent that we have proven those things or that we mm-hmm. have studied them in any detail yet in a controlled way. But I do think we're going to start finding some of those things. And at minimum, I would urge my other colleagues to start looking not only at, are we having negative outcomes with starting diets? But are we having positive outcomes that may reach outside our field?
Yeah. Look at the data. Collaborate with whoever is in charge of that at your facility to see, hey, can we look at this one variable and to see if there's a correlation between this and some other outcomes, one way or the other. And that's not that controlled. And you got to look at some of the potential ethical things with that too. But I think there's a way to do it. So let's see here. We should probably wrap up.
How do you want to land this plane?
How do I want to land this plane? I think there are a lot of ways to land it. I think that we have not just a plane, but we have this huge aircraft carrier that has just unleashed all of these drones going everywhere. And the thing that's cool about this is there's so many different directions. There's so many positive things that could come out of this that like any one person listening to this episode can be like, yes, this one is for me. I can do this in whatever capacity in this area. So there's so many ways that this can go. And that's great. And I am biased, but I think that some of the listeners to this are really of the mindset of improving things as they are. And yeah. I am so honored by the emails that I get sometime that someone says, well, that episode resonated with me because of XYZ. Like, I want to go do this now because that's what matters. I wanted to say this earlier and I was like, I'll save it for the end because I think it's a good way to dovetail out of everything. But the idea you mentioned that, at least in research, in some areas, like we're doing a lot of stuff in isolation. So even if we're doing working clinically, we're still kind of isolated. There aren't three other clinicians typically in the room with us while we're doing a clinical swallow eval or an aphasia eval or whatever. And so this idea of when you're struggling alone, whether it's with anything, you're struggling alone, but we can't do this alone. You can't struggle alone and get through everything. You get so much perspective, you get comfort, you get so many things from other people. And so I think in this capacity that if we're just looking at ourselves or our field in the mirror regarding dysphagia management, and we see some of these outcomes, like you mentioned earlier, 55% of those are MPO with no instrumentation, 61% of SNF residents with feeding tubes, no dysphagia, 67% with a modified diet had no dysphagia. And you can look at other articles that came out and talk about like ability to identify pathophysiology, differentiate normal from abnormal swallowing. It's like, that's just, it's a mirror. And there's nuance to that. And I don't want to oversimplify that and just be like, oh, we're messing up, it's so bad, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of nuance to it. And I think we need to acknowledge that. But it's still a mirror. It represents what is. And we have to understand what is to be able to move forward. But I think looking in that with isolation, that it shows all of our imperfections and it can lead to lost hope. But by having conversations like this, talking, finding other people who are like-minded, maybe convincing other colleagues to be like-minded, talking about this stuff and getting them excited that through working together, we can reignite the potential for hope that exists. I'm really happy to see that. Sorry, Matt, you were going to say something.
No, I mean, I agree. Looking at the imperfections of our field for me is something that is a net positive and net exciting thing. Mm-hmm. Because what I am looking for, one of the reasons I got into research is largely I wanted to be able to nudge our field forward, even just a millimeter. If I can be a part of that, I'm happy. So looking at imperfections is not to say anything other than this is just how things are. It's not a judgment on any one person or any group of people or anyone who came before me. I know if I existed at different times in our profession, I would be talking about different things and thinking about different things.
Sure.
But if someone is out there listening and they're struggling, this stuff can be a struggle and can be ugly to look at, but it also can be very exciting. And for me, I meant what I said earlier. My friends who I work with, my friends who I talk to, it does seem like there is a renaissance in dysphagia treatment and that it is some of the people who I have talked to have some of the most exciting research questions they're asking. Some of the most exciting treatment benefits for patients are happening right now. So if you're out there and you're feeling alone and it's hard, I want to validate those feelings. I've been that guy. I've been out there. I felt alone. I have felt despair. There are a lot of times when I read about a profession that I feel despair. But I do also want to say there's a lot of people out there, a not insignificant portion of people who are looking and trying to make it better. And just, I want to say that's what Thomas Merton, the monk, said. Just, I don't know if what I'm doing pleases you, but the desire to please you, I hope, is what pleases you. And that's how I feel about our profession. My desire is to make our profession better. I don't know if I am, but I hope that desire at least translates and helps other people have that desire as well, because I do believe there's a whole lot more good in our profession than there is really and truly bad. There's a lot of things we need to shore up, but that's not different than other professions.
Yeah. And that doesn't speak to our character and our potential and our willingness to get better. So I truly think that what you have uncovered in this article is going to be more of a mirror so we can see things as they are. And I think that in turn is going to help us to get better because I think we have a resilient profession. I think we have individuals who are in this to help people and who are dedicated to helping people. And this just helps us to better understand how to do it. So I couldn't think of really, or it would be hard for me to think of really more of an appropriate topic to finish up the season than to look at this glimmer of hope. And so one other thing that I'm going to mention with it is you're getting ready to finish your PhD. And I see that as the culmination of a tremendous amount of work. And I'm also looking at this like analogous to our profession, right? Like when you were in your PhD, you probably were told a lot of things about yourself you didn't want to hear. Like, hey, you need to work on your writing. You need to do this or that or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I remember Angela Duckworth, if you're familiar with the book Grit, and she won the MacArthur Genius Grant. It's very prestigious. It's like going to the top 1% of somebody in their field. And she says when she did her first TED Talk, she was expecting them to come back and tell her all the great things she did. And all they did was have this laundry list of things that she did wrong during her TED Talk. Mm. And because the goal of our profession shouldn't be for anyone to ever make you feel good. It's just to produce what's best for our patients. And while it doesn't always feel comfortable to have someone say, hey, you could do that better, or hey, we as a field could do this or that better, you're right. It is hard to divorce that from who we are inside and how it makes us feel. But when we're saying that, we're just saying it because mm-hmm. we're dealing with in a field with patients, someone who is not us. And when we're mm-hmm. trying to make their lives better, I do believe we can accept a little bit of the personal cost of not feeling great about ourselves all the time.
Yeah.
If it makes our patients' lives better.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying there. And I agree with what you're saying, that to become better, we have to look at the things that aren't great. Even in medicine, you're looking for the things that are not great. You want to look at the things that are doing, you know, patients are doing well to capitalize on those things. But at the same time, if you're one of the things we're looking for is pathophysiology and why, it's so we can rehabilitate it. It's not because we want to tell the patient like, oh, look at you, you have dysphagia. If we just sign off after that, what good are we doing? Versus you have dysphagia and these are some of the potential implications. This is what I think will help and this is why. Would you like to pursue that? Like, that's kind of more of what we're doing. But this analogy with you with your PhD that I was getting to is like, you're getting ready to finish it. Oh, super soon, yeah. Like a week or something like that. I want to call you Dr. Matt now, but I can't do that. I don't want to get you in trouble. But what I'm saying with that is like, you received feedback, you received constructive yeah. criticism. You went through this whole process and it, you know, birthed this brilliant mind or refined this brilliant mind who's going to have a PhD. And so like, I'm seeing that analogous to some of the things our profession are going through. Like, let's not forget who we can become. And I hope that maybe we're getting to that sooner or later, that maybe this is good. These are the labor pains, right? The yeah. labor pains of what we're going through. And we could just become something spectacular and magnificent. So in my mind, I'm just going to say, that's what's going to happen. That's what's going to happen. It well, can yeah. be. That's the potential.
And I believe it starts with sort of de-siloing our profession. Not necessarily, we always talk about, we don't always collaborate, even in interdisciplinary teams. But I do believe there's kind of a divide in our profession right now between people who feel like they're trying to push the profession forward and people who feel like, I just kind of want to do my job. And there is nothing wrong, I do believe, with either one of those camps. But I believe it's really easy to get dispirited by someone asking you to constantly change. Like, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
not anything wrong. Constant change is what we signed up for. I do feel like I need to say that to people. Constant change is what we signed up for. And so getting used to being a little uncomfortable and being able to have professional discussions, not just mm-hmm. disconnect from other people who may not feel the same as you, starts within our own profession. Because I do believe until we start really talking to each other instead of talking mm-hmm. past each other yeah. or not listening, just waiting for our turn to talk and present all the evidence that we want to for whatever we're talking about. Until we do that, it's going to be really hard for us to de-silo and start working with other professions, because I do believe most of the data that we're going to need is going to come from outside of our field, not just SLPs. But until yeah. we're able to work nicely with each other, I think it's going to be really hard for us to work nicely with other people as well. Does that make sense? I don't know if it makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that does help a lot. One consideration too is, though, even for the things that are wrong, if there are things that are wrong or if there are mistakes or things that need to become better, it's our perspective with that too. It's not necessarily like a personal criticism, but it's just like, oh, that's an opportunity for me to become better. Like, I already think I'm doing okay, but I can become even better, right? That sort of thing. Yeah. It's a framework. It's a mindset as well. So, but Matt, thank you so much for coming on here. I appreciate all that you were able to illuminate. Didn't talk necessarily just about the article, but really, I think more broadly. So if you haven't read this article already, check out by Ed Weiss, Christine with a K, Kristine, Gaelic. Did I say that right? Yep. Galek. And Matthew Ward, who I have with me today. The article is titled Dysphagia and Diets in Skilled Nursing Facilities: When Patients' Health Status Changes, the Role of Imaging. So check out that for more information.
And I will say that article is behind a paywall now. There is an email attached to the first author of any publication. And the first author cannot mass distribute an article, but they can send it personally. So if you really want a copy of this article, you really need a copy of this article for your own personal use, email Ed. He's the first author. And much like any other first author, typically, if they get that email, they'd be happy to send you a copy of this article. But just knowing that academic journals, that's a whole other thing. But being behind a paywall and not being in an SLP journal makes this article a little bit harder to sort of get a hold of all of it. Sure. And some of the nuance of this article, not just the abstract, some of the nuance is really interesting. So I know a lot of people might need this if they're trying to make an argument for getting more instrumental studies in their buildings. If you do that, feel free to email one of the authors. We'd be happy to provide you with a personal copy of that article.
Tim and Matt sent you so that Ed can just hate us for his inbox being full. But right. I doubt that'll be Ed. I think he'll be happy to get this information out.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much, Matt. I truly appreciate it. Congrats on the culmination of the rewards of all of your hard work. That's excellent. And I hope to see you around.
Appreciate it. Anytime.
Thank you for listening. That's the end of season one. That's 16 episodes in about 16 hours. We wrapped up this season with some startling statistics and set our focus on improving patient care. I hope we put enough focus on the transformative potential that has come about from our profession's reflection, resilience, and a growth mindset. Although season one is finished, there may be some surprises to hold you over, so please subscribe to our mailing list at swallowthegap.com as to not miss out. You can also follow Gap Education on Facebook or follow swallowpatho, that's swallow, P-A-T-H-O, on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you, and I posted a survey to solicit your ideas for next season, but also to hear about your favorite episode from this season. You can find the survey at swallowthegap.com/survey. This Saturday will be Gap Education's webinar on dysphagia management in patients with pulmonary compromise, ICU and beyond. Check it out at swallowthegap.com/live courses. I'm already excited for what's coming up in season two, and I cannot say this enough. Thank you for listening. Thank you for keeping this going. Please keep in touch, and I hope to see you soon.